Hello, Mr. Lop, and welcome to the Crypto Insider interview. I'm Vlad, and today I will be asking you a few questions for about 30 minutes. And I just want you to know that I'm very happy to have you here, and this is a true honor and privilege for me.
My pleasure. Fire away.
So you want me to start with the hard questions?
Go for it.
I have quite a few from people whom I've asked for questions in the last week. And my boss actually has a few for you, like Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash. How do you destroy the arguments of Roger Ver? Do you think that there's anything good about Bitcoin Cash?
You know, this is an incredibly complex topic that we could easily spend the entire time discussing. But, you know, what it really comes down to is that there are no absolutes. You know, everyone has their own perspective and their own version of the truth and their own things that they're trying to optimize for. So, you know, the best way I can kind of break down the Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash thing is, you know, Bitcoin is trying to optimize for a low cost of full validation of the entire history of the chain at the possible expense of high cost of transacting, whereas Bitcoin Cash is doing the opposite and trying to optimize for a very low cost of transacting at the potential high cost of fully validating the chain. And so, I mean, these are trade-offs, and it ultimately comes down to philosophical differences. And then, you know, you can get into issues of governance and sovereignty and all of that. And so, you know, I can't authoritatively state that, you know, Bitcoin Cash should not exist, or that, you know, they don't have the right to do whatever they want, and, you know, pursue the path that they want to see happen with you know, what they believe, like the real vision of Satoshi and the future of Bitcoin is. All I know is that I and a lot of people that I talk to are like-minded in that we prefer to optimize for self-sovereignty and enabling as many people as possible to operate in this permissionless and trustless environment. And that does mean that there are going to be pain points along the way at which, you know, people are using the system in an inefficient manner, and it causes problems for everyone else because this is a scarce resource. It's a common resource, the actual block space. And it's just something that we're going to have to deal with. And I think that you know, the ecosystem has dealt with it pretty well over the past year. A lot of businesses have optimized how they're using the blockchain. And now we have a number of different efforts that are working on both making the protocol better and making businesses better understand how to use Bitcoin in more efficient ways. So, you know, it's an ongoing process. And I think that some people are never going to stop debating what the future should be, but I'm more interested in building my vision and trying to collaborate with people who share that vision.
This just came to my mind while you're talking about whether or not you should be dismissing or telling projects that they should not exist. What do you think about the differences between Litecoin and Bitcoin Cash? They are very similar in many ways. They both have similar technologies. They use different mining algorithms. But at the end of the day, they have the same approach. So which one of them do you think will live longer as a project or may have a greater success?
You know, it seems like the Litecoin developers are more closely aligned with the mindset of the Bitcoin developers. And, you know, they're willing to adopt these more cutting edge, like layer two technologies. So I would expect, at least from like a scalability standpoint, that, you know, Litecoin is going to be able to scale orders of magnitude greater than Bitcoin Cash, you know, without increasing the cost of actually validating that chain. So it does get kind of weird when you start trying to compare all of these different things, and the fact that there is hundreds, if not thousands, of you know, blockchain-based networks out there that you can transact cheaply on. And, you know, the reason you can transact cheaply on them is because not many people are using them, and they're not being pushed to the limits of what those networks can support. So, you know, it's, I think, going to be a never-ending thing where, you know, there's just a lot of, you know, marketing and propaganda going on until these networks actually reach their limits. And we see, you know, this is actually as far as you can go with the current protocol. And that's actually why it's interesting to see adoption happen to the point that it starts to hurt, is because that's when the engineers can then step in and say, okay, you know, these are the bottlenecks and these are the things that need to change if we want to take it to the next level of adoption.
Okay. So I'll ask another question, which I received from a guy named Laurențiu. He's also Romanian and he follows me. And he says, ask Jameson Lopp, please, how can we make Bitcoin better and how would it look? What would it look like in the space when all the Bitcoins are mined? I think that's the more interesting question of the two.
Yeah, well, how can we make Bitcoin better? Really comes down to the fact that, you know, this is a distributed open system where if you want to collaborate, if you want to use your skills and resources, it's kind of up to you. You know, I'm not a project manager of Bitcoin, the project. I can't sit here and tell you, you know, you need to do this and you need to do that. Really, it's more incumbent. Like, the freedom of the system means that it's also relying upon you to decide, you know, what is your skill set? How can you best apply your skills to the system? That doesn't mean that you have to be a programmer and you have to write for the protocol implementations or write for applications or whatever. I mean, if you're a marketer or a writer or a technical writer or whatever, you might write different blog posts or different things on social media to try to help educate people. Heck, if you're a good illustrator and you've got a sense of humor, you can make memes. You know, memes are even a very interesting way of like spreading the viral effect and getting people interested and keeping them engaged. You know, kind of one of the things that people ask me very often is, what is Bitcoin's biggest weakness, or what is the most likely thing to kill Bitcoin? And my standard answer to that is apathy. Like, the Bitcoin project can only die if we all agree to give up on it and stop contributing to it. So, you know, keeping engagement and education and continuing to grow the ecosystem in every possible way is how we continue building it and keeping it from dying, keeping people from you know, leaving and going and spending their time and energy doing anything else. As for like the mining issue, you know, this is one of the reasons why a lot of us believe that it is important to have the fee market pressure that, you know, does cause a lot of conflict and anxiety and poor user experience as we're trying to figure out how to navigate the fee market, because as the block reward and the subsidy keeps going down, if we don't compensate for the new Bitcoins that are no longer being created to pay for the miners with, you know, increased transaction fees, then that just means that like the amount of value that is being paid to secure the network in terms of the computational hash power is going to decrease. So you could also argue that, you know, increasing the exchange rate as the subsidy keeps going down would also offset that, but that's not really something we have much control over. I think it's more feasible to try to help this fee market continue to develop. And so while, you know, it'll be like 100 years before the very last of the Bitcoins get mined, I think it's only in, you know, the next 10 or 20 years that the vast majority of them will already have been mined. And so that's why I think that over the next 5-10 years, we need to continue to develop a fee market and be offsetting the subsidies. because otherwise, I think Bitcoin would continue to exist. It's just there would be less hash power and less security. Basically, it would be cheaper for other people to start rewriting the blockchain, and that would be a very bad thing. You know, we want Bitcoin to be so secure that even like first world countries do not find it profitable to, you know, buy up or confiscate a bunch of mining equipment and try to do a 51% attack on the whole network. So, you know, if you operate under the assumption that we're trying to go for like a greater than nation state level of computational security, then we need to be paying millions of dollars a day, basically, for the security.
I just had this thought because you mentioned your approach and your vision to Bitcoin Cash and Litecoin. And I've read all these articles which claim that they are such a hazard for the environment and we should stop mining as much. And I was just thinking, do you think there is room for more than one proof of work coin in the space? Or maybe at some point, some coins like Litecoin, like Bitcoin Cash, like Zcash or whatever, the ones which require mining, they might switch to proof of stake just to power up Bitcoin if we get to that point where we all acknowledge its power and its influence in the space and its importance. You think that they will all just use the hash power to give it to Bitcoin to secure it?
Well, I mean, my opinion is that if you want a high level of guaranteed security, that there can only be one, at least one proof of work per algorithm, you know, and thus per type of ASIC coin that is going to dominate. So that's simply because, like, you can look at, for example, all of the SHA-256 hashing algorithm coins out there, Bitcoin and the vast majority of the forks, where last I checked, I think that Bitcoin Cash had between like 5% and 8% of the hash power of Bitcoin, which means that theoretically, almost any pool, any like pool in Bitcoin, that pool operator could on a whim decide to redirect that hash power and start 51% attacking Bitcoin Cash. Now, there's plenty of reasons why I think that hasn't happened. You know, it would cause a lot of disruption in the community in general and may not be, you know, long-term profitable due to the loss of confidence that would happen. But, you know, if you want the ultimate, even like theoretical security, then I think you have to be like top dog of whatever your proof of work algorithm is. So, you know, actually, if I recall correctly, Dogecoin was using the same script mining as Litecoin. And then a few years ago, they actually came to an agreement to like merge mine Dogecoin with Litecoin. So that was another interesting development there. Because I think, you know, Litecoin miners could have easily like, 51% attacked Dogecoin. So there, you can also get into symbiotic relationships. But, you know, you can also argue about how theoretical are these types of attacks since they don't seem to happen that often in the real world. But if we are talking about like having the absolute best guarantee security, then I think that there can only be one, you know, top contender for each of these algorithms. Whether or not, you know, proof of stake becomes a thing, you know, that's a whole other tricky issue because, you know, proof of stake has its own share of issues, especially concerning like long-term attacks, long-term reorgs, this like nobility problem. Then there's also the issue of, well, you're actually using resources inside of the system to secure the system as opposed to using external resources, aka electricity and ASICs and whatnot. And you know, that also can turn into kind of a philosophical argument, but I think the most important thing is that right now there aren't any really great proof of stake systems that have been deployed into production that, you know, don't have other basically kludgy things bolted onto them. Like most of the proof of stake systems that I've seen have ended up having like regular developer checkpoints or ended up being this like delegated proof of stake, which is really more of a federation. So you're basically creating completely different security models than what you get with proof of work. And of course, we could argue about the like pros and cons of all of those for a long time as well. But, you know, I think, you know, there is a concerted effort, especially by the Ethereum folks, to try to find a better form of proof of stake that is good enough. You know, I don't think any of these things will ever be perfect, but if we can build one that at least is so expensive to attack that we effectively don't see any attacks, then I think it'll get plenty of adoption. I'm not saying that I personally would adopt it. We'll see.
Do you think that the Ethereum people will do a good job with their Casper implementation? Because there seems to be a lot of rumors and a lot of talks about Vitalik's version or Vlad Zamfir's version. And they seem to have different philosophies. They might have reached at this point when they saw all these Ethereum killers just take away some of their market share. They might have reached some sort of consensus and maybe they want to speed up the implementation because it has been almost 2 years or more. I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're on the bleeding edge of creating these new consensus protocols. And, you know, it seems like they're constantly rethinking the work that they've done. And so, you know, it's hard to believe that they have stumbled upon the like optimal version of whatever this protocol should be, because it's, you know, still changing. I think, you know, just a few days ago, they basically had a consensus failure of their testnet, and you know, that in and of itself doesn't mean that the whole thing is flawed. It just means there's, at the very least, there's still some bugs that need to be worked out. And when it comes to building, you know, these type of networks, you know, you can never be 100% sure that it's bug free. It more comes down to, well, the system has been running for this long and is securing this many million or billion dollars worth of assets and has not been successfully attacked. So it's one of those, you know, we have to wait and see type deals before we can evaluate it better.
So do you think that Ethereum will ultimately be its own killer in the sense that you have EOS, you have Tezos, you have NEO? I think I can name like five more, but I'm not going to do it. But do you think that Ethereum will overcome its issues and just get back its community and its part of the market?
You know, I think that if and when they do deploy their proof of stake system, you know, there are a lot of people who are holding on to their Ether because they want to stake it and they want to, you know, basically, you know, earn interest on those tokens that they've been holding on to, so that, you know, that will create like a renewed sense of enthusiasm and whatnot. I think the bigger question for me is actually the scalability of like their sharding implementation, and, you know, also how that changes the security model, because from what I have read about it, you know, it very drastically changes the security model of you know, from what a fully validating node on the network today, which I would argue there actually aren't that many on Ethereum, will eventually, you know, become this sharded node that will only see a very tiny aspect of what's going on the network. And, you know, how that ends up like playing off of all the other shards and whether or not there are consensus failures between the different shards and how that's all handled. Like, that's a big question mark, which is going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. But I think if they do succeed in the sharding plan, the last I saw is that I think they were estimating, you know, maybe like 200x throughput, which is pretty significant, but you still come across this fundamental issue of, you know, doing all of these computations on the blockchain, even if it's a sharded blockchain, It's very difficult to foresee how you end up having this single world computer that is actually used at a mainstream level. Personally, I believe that like Ethereum will become adopted more as a protocol and as a virtual machine than necessarily the main Ethereum network. And we've already actually seen this happen. Like there's a number of different like private and permissioned networks out there that are based on the Ethereum virtual machine. And you know, there's even RSK, which is the Bitcoin sidechain that supports the Ethereum virtual machine. So I think Ethereum has shown there's very clear use case for having this type of more generic developer-friendly smart contract language. It's a bigger question in my mind as to how, like what the final form of that actually being adopted and implemented is. And it may not be on the main Ethereum network.
Do you think that Ethereum Classic has it right in its approach? Because they say they support immutability. They want to be what the original project wanted to be. But at the same time, they don't show any signs of increasing scalability, and they haven't had any issues just because they weren't challenged up to this point. But do you think that at some point in the future, they will fail or maybe succeed in their attempt? They want to focus on Internet of Things and maybe have smaller applications, not necessarily something like CryptoKitties, which will freeze their blockchain. But at the same time, they're also permissionless. So anyone can deploy an application on their blockchain. So if anyone is malevolent, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, malevolent.
Malevolent. If anyone is malevolent, then they can just freeze their blockchain.
I mean, I would say I probably align philosophically with the classic developers more, but you know, I think they're also at a huge disadvantage simply because it's such a smaller group. They don't have the same manpower and skills basically dedicated to building out that network. So from that standpoint, I think it's going to be more challenging for them to try to be a serious contender in the space.
That's very diplomatic of you. You didn't make any assumptions about the future of it, but you said it's going to be challenging. I can take that. Because now let's get back to Bitcoin. I've seen your involvement in the B Foundation, which wasn't supposed to be called a foundation. It was supposed to be just the B. But as I've learned from Giacomo, he told me that at first it was just the B, but then he had to fill in some forms and he had to make it a foundation for legal reasons. And that leaked and it didn't end so well just because people have such a bitter memory of the Bitcoin Foundation, which somehow still exists for reasons. But what is your involvement more precisely?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's more of a like a branding versus a legal technical issue, I guess. I'll probably generally be referring to it as the B, but for legal reasons, it has to have foundation on the legal documents. So really, Giacomo is driving this effort because he was basically doing similar stuff with his BHB network in Italy, where he was funding various projects basically on his own. And then Elena is the force behind the legal entity, but she's taking more of a hands-off approach and doing more of the advising, which is what the rest of us are doing, which basically means that, we're all in a chat room and email list and discussing various decisions that will need to be made. This is mostly going to be fairly inane stuff of saying, well, do we want to put this project in our tree of donations that people can say that they want to allocate funds to? What are the major initiatives that we want to try to fund in this space? I think inevitably there probably will be some more contention around like outreach efforts. Some people are going to get triggered and think that we're trying to like represent the ecosystem or various aspects of the ecosystem. I was pretty clear up front that, you know, I don't want to be involved in anything that is like trying to lobby governments or trying to, you know, create propaganda or perspectives of what people believe Bitcoin should be. Rather, I'm interested in trying to fund different projects that are trying to build on top of Bitcoin and Lightning and what other, you know, side chains, really any other technologies that are building on top of Bitcoin, just to try to continue to spur adoption and developer interest in the system. And I was actually trying to do something like this on my own about a year ago. I was talking to attorneys in the United States, trying to figure out if I could form a charitable organization. And it turns out the IRS in the United States made it very difficult to do that for open source software projects about 15 years ago. So there's only like three or four out there, like the Linux Foundation, that are actually charitable organizations that support free and open source software development. And then, you know, when Elena came to me and was saying, you know, she was trying to do something similar, but she was doing it in Liechtenstein because the legal environment seems to be better there, I said, you know, I'm all in, and, you know, whatever I can do to contribute will be great. And, you know, and then it turns out there's a lot of other people in the space who have been, you know, thinking the same thing. And just from conversations I've had over the years, I think that there is a fair amount of demand and funding out there that would be interested in basically helping grow the ecosystem by donating to different projects, but there just hasn't been a good vehicle for it. And, you know, I think the Bitcoin Foundation had an opportunity to do that, but they made a number of mistakes. They stretched themselves too thin. They tried to be everything for Bitcoin. And I'm hoping that by keeping a much more narrow focus on more of the technical side of things, that we can succeed where they failed.
I think you are just too nice with the Bitcoin Foundation, because it had financial interest in the first place. So it didn't begin as something which wanted to preserve or improve the protocol, or maybe help with scholarships for the next generation of developers to emerge. It was just made out of Charlie Shrem and who else was on board.
It was more of an industry association, but then I think that they also compounded their issues. You know, without talking about the specific personalities, you know, there were a number of people there who ended up having legal issues, which didn't help. But they also made it, of course, this general membership organization, and they created a very rigid bureaucracy, basically. And I think the bureaucracy didn't help. It probably slowed things down and also like resulted in making it easy for, you know, misappropriation and misallocation of resources, because they ended up blowing through I don't even know how many tens of millions of dollars, where if they had, you know, taken a longer term approach and held on to some of those funds, then, you know, they would have been easily sustained for 10 years, if not longer. And I think that the main reason that they still exist, because I still read the meeting notes from time to time, it seems like mainly from donations of the board members. Like I know Brock Pierce has been donating a significant amount of Ether to the Bitcoin Foundation. And of course, that lost a lot of value over the past year. So the Bitcoin Foundation lost a lot of money. But, you know, they can continue doing whatever they feel like doing. It just seems like they're not doing much anymore. I'm not entirely sure why they exist. You know, Francis Poulier, who is helping with the B now, you know, he was on the Bitcoin Foundation board, and he seemed to indicate that, you know, it was mostly just a phone call once a month or so, and not much else actually going on.
I think at the end of the day, Bitcoin does need lobbying, but it doesn't have to be centralized. So you can just speak on your behalf as a person who is involved in Bitcoin, but it doesn't make much sense for a protocol which is distributed and at the same time it's open source. You shouldn't be speaking on behalf of everybody, because usually you find that there are so many dissonances and differences of opinion. Is that how you pronounce it? Dissonances?
Yeah, dissonance.
No, the plural form. Dissonance is the singular, but the plural?
I think the plural is the same as the singular.
Really? Okay, I'm going to look it up after. But I'm about to ask you about the Liquid Network, which Blockstream has launched a few days ago. You think ultimately that it's a good idea to centralize some transactions from the exchanges and have a side chain just for them as a way of decongesting the main chain? A lot of people seem to be skeptical and point out to Blockstream that they're actually turning Bitcoin into something which they don't like, but at the same time, it's not mandatory to use it. If it fails, you still have Bitcoin the way we know it and we use it.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, I have a very privileged perspective of this, and that is because I spent 3 years working at BitGo. And BitGo, of course, services a lot of the large crypto exchanges out there. So we actually had the ability to see what some of the fund flows look like between exchanges. And what we could tell very easily is that there is a lot of redundant fund flows between exchanges. And you know, the reason for this is that when you have 10,000 users on like OKCoin and they also have accounts on Bitstamp, and you know they want to send money from OKCoin to Bitstamp, then each of those users is going to request a withdrawal from OKCoin and put in their Bitstamp address and click, you know, submit and do whatever other security things are required. And then OKCoin is just going to see this, you know, list of addresses, and they might be a little bit efficient. They might, you know, batch them up in a few transactions with a lot of outputs, but still at the end of the day, they're going to be creating a lot of transactions and a lot of UTXOs to essentially move money from one entity to another. So, you know, this is highly inefficient, and the reason for this is, you know, mainly due to the pseudonymous, like, semi-private nature of the network. It's because OKCoin doesn't know that all of these users are sending it to Bitstamp, you know, to the same entity. All they see are these random addresses. And take that, you know, particular example and basically multiply it by a factor of, like, n factorial for however many different exchanges there are and users on those exchanges. And I think that as a result, you know, there is a significant fraction of block space that is being used up doing nothing more than sending money from one exchange to another back and forth as users are rebalancing their accounts and you know, just going about their normal activities. So there's a couple of different ways, of course, that you can try to get around that and make that more efficient. One way would be to like kill off the privacy and have, you know, people identify that they're sending to a specific exchange, and then, you know, the exchanges can form these private agreements and kind of like settle up on a daily basis, not unlike banks. Another way is that, you know, you can use a second layer network. So, you know, hopefully one day, you know, all of the exchanges will also be integrated with one another on the Lightning Network. And a lot of these cross exchange transactions can happen on the Lightning Network. But we're not there yet. And, you know, it's unclear how long it's going to take before we see major exchanges adopting Lightning Network for withdrawals and deposits. I think one or two small exchanges already have. And then, of course, another way is like another, you could call it second layer solution, use some sort of side chain, some other thing that is cryptographically tied to Bitcoin. And so Liquid is one of those. It just happens to be like more permissioned than Lightning is. But I think it's going to be like a faster way to get towards that. you know, they've been working on Liquid for years and now they're actually deploying it. Hopefully this will, you know, give us a bit more congestion reduction in the near term and kind of provide a stopgap solution, at least until Lightning becomes more of a thing. And, you know, maybe it takes off and it also ends up doing a ton of transaction volume itself, because remember that it's also got additional privacy features that you don't get on Bitcoin. Arguably better privacy even than you would get on Lightning Network, though it's kind of hard to compare those two things. But yeah, I mean, you know, nobody is forced to use Liquid either. So, you know, from a moral perspective, I have no problem with it. From a technical perspective, if people, you know, look at the security model and the privacy model that Liquid offers to them and they decide that Liquid is going to benefit their use case, then by all means, I think they should use it.
I think the only part about the Liquid network, which I do not understand very clearly, is how they want to be geographically diverse, in the sense that they don't want to concentrate too many exchanges from one continent or one country, so that the political factor, like the government which imposes new policies, shouldn't shift the governance of the sidechain as a whole. But at the same time, we can see that exchanges are very much concentrated in certain countries, some which offer maybe better financial policies, better tax situations. So I find it hard to understand how they're going to make this work and how they're going to maintain the balance.
Yeah, I mean, that is the tricky thing when you have a federation, though. You know, you could argue that they have a little more control over that balance than we have in a, you know, more permissionless system like with miners. You know, basically nobody can control what the geographic distribution of miners is. That's more of an issue of just sort of natural resources and a ton of other factors that are the outside of the control of pretty much any human. So, I mean, but yeah, I mean, it's a different security model, and it may be difficult to reason about, especially if you're looking at the sort of nation state attacker level. I guess the ultimate end game scenario, though, is, you know, what is the worst thing that can possibly happen if you're using Liquid? If, say, there was some sort of even multi-nation state level attack that manages to shut down the whole Liquid network, my understanding is that you should still be able to then basically retrieve your coins back, you know, on the main Bitcoin chain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as long as it is, you know, protected against like total loss of funds, which seems to be the entire point of a sidechain, is that you can screw around on there. And even if the sidechain fails, no one should actually lose money. That seems like a win-win.
I was thinking about this model of governance, that at some point we might see a Chinese exchange which wants to get in, but they will say, no, we'll just wait until another US exchange gets in so that we have balance, and another one from Korea, and they want to have this sort of harmony, which maybe that it's a good idea. And I also like the fact that they don't care about the size or the volume of the exchange. They don't care if it's Coinbase or Binance or OKCoin. They just want to have one exchange, one vote. But then again, that can also be exploited in the sense that you can divide a big exchange into smaller divisions and have more voting power.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to be wary of the type of issues that we've seen in like EOS, for example, of like block producers voting for themselves and all of that.
So yeah, that was nasty, but at the same time, it's expected. Corruption is part of the human nature, even though we don't define it as corruption. It's just, you know, back in the ancient times, it was all about how about the two of us get together and beat that guy because we're stronger together. It's about the incentive and maybe accomplishing something which otherwise you wouldn't be able to do by yourself. So
yeah, It's all about incentives. It
should have been expected on their behalf. I remember Vitalik was bragging on Twitter and saying, oh, I knew it all along and I told you so that this would happen. But I have no idea how EOS is still functional in the sense that people trust it and they deploy applications. And maybe that it's just because they have so much Ethereum to burn and they can maintain themselves at that high position and they can pay for advertisement. They can remain relevant just because they're wealthy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of regular users don't really worry about sort of edge case scenarios, and that as long as a system seems to work, then they're not really concerned with, you know, what might cause it to fail. Unless it actually fails, they generally don't care. Like, you could be right on the brink of failure, but if the users don't actually notice, then it's not a huge deal.
Plus, I think if you have a dApp and you deploy it on EOS, I think if it fails, you can just move it somewhere else, even though you're not going to have the data from the blockchain, maybe. You will just take the same technology, the same application, and use it somewhere else. But I've had this conversation with Jimmy Song on Friday, and he wrote that controversial tweet that you should be spending with your credit card because it makes so much more sense from an economic point of view. And when you use Bitcoin to purchase, you're actually selling it. And that's not rational in any way because it costs you much more. And he explained it to me, and then he wrote an article earlier today. And are you adhering to this type of economic thought, or do you think that we should be using Bitcoin as much as we can to increase the volume?
You know, I've actually come across several checkout pages recently where I saw that Bitcoin was an option and I ended up not choosing it. And the reason was severalfold. One, I think that my use of disposable debit cards is actually going to afford me more privacy than Bitcoin right now. Bitcoin is not very good on the privacy front. You know, if I was paying in Monero, that would be a very different story. Also, there is the issue of speculation on what the value will be, where right now I'm fairly confident that we're at the bottom of a bear market, and that anything that I spend or effectively sell, is going to be a lost opportunity cost where I will basically end up being better off in the long run if I hold on to it. And also kind of related to that is that every time I spend/sell, I am actually making my life more complicated from a tax standpoint. I have to go into my capital gains spreadsheet and once again figure out like what was the cost basis of those Bitcoins, what is the amount of tax that I need to pay as a result. And I can tell you my tax situation from last year was a huge nightmare, and I'm trying to avoid that as much as possible. So, you know, in general, I'm not spending because it would also just be, it's going to complicate my life. If I do want to go with the like spend and replace strategy, then it means that I'm going and getting my hardware wallet. I'm actually creating the transaction to purchase the thing. And then I have to go to some other exchange or broker and do yet another transaction that, you know, buys back those Bitcoins that I just spent. And then that again, you know, creates new entries in my personal accounting ledger for, okay, now I have a new cost basis for these Bitcoins and I have to keep track of that. And then eventually when I sell them. So, it complicates my life and I try to avoid doing it. And, you know, hopefully, you know, those things will become less complicated over time. Like, I would really like to see some sort of law in the United States and preferably anywhere else that this affects of, you know, getting rid of the need to pay for capital gains transactions for, you know, anything under a certain amount. I think there was like a bill in the United States to try to set that at like $500 or something. So, you know, if you're having to figure out capital gains for every cup of coffee or every like $20 widget that you're buying on the internet, like that's a huge turnoff. And that's what results in me generally only selling larger blocks of crypto, because it complicates my life less.
You know, I never really thought about this, because here in Romania, we don't have any piece of legislation which even remotely or vaguely mentions Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies. So if you have Bitcoin and you purchase stuff with it, it's like you're not even using a form of money which they acknowledge. So you can easily do tax evasion or launder money in this country. And we even have like Bitcoin ATMs, but they have high fees. So if you withdraw from those machines, you actually pay a lot of money, like 7 to 10%. But I assume that to somebody who bought early on and maybe wants to take out some cash, they can do it so easily. But I'm happy you mentioned privacy earlier, as I've seen that many of your posts and articles are actually about privacy and how you're trying to rebuild your life, like start anew and have a new, I'm not sure if identity, but have a new life in which you're being more cautious about your privacy in your day-to-day affairs. And I even saw that, I'm not sure if it was funny or sad, but you refused to go on a ride in a roller coaster, I think, just because you had a debit card which didn't have a name. It's a disposable one.
Yeah, well, you know, that created some additional complication. The stupid thing, I don't think I followed up on it, but the reason that was a stupid event where they... Basically, I purchased the ticket online and used throwaway emails and debit cards and throwaway billing information. And then I got to the actual park and tried to claim my ticket. And they basically started interrogating me. And then were asking, you know, why didn't you use your credit cards and other stuff that's, you know, tied to your real name? Because basically they have some sort of data surveillance system where they try to positively identify that you are the actual purchaser of the ticket. The reason it was stupid that they rejected my ticket and refunded it was because when I showed up at the park, I gave them my passport and my fingerprint. Like they were, you know, doing biometric identification for everyone who entered the gates. So it was really stupid that they claimed that they couldn't identify me because I was giving them my passport, and I ended up buying a new ticket with cash right there on the spot. So I don't know what they thought that they were like protecting themselves or protecting other people from. It was just one of those things where like they had, you know, bureaucracy in place and their system said that they had to reject me using that specific payment method.
Oh man, that's insane. So you had to give them your fingerprint and your passport just because you went to a park?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't think that I've gone to many amusement parks outside of America, maybe none, but this is becoming a very common thing in America. And I can only assume that it's due to, you know, terrorism fears and whatnot, is that they're afraid that someone's going to come in and, you know, just, you know, do a mass shooting or a bombing or something like that. And so pretty much all of these parks have very high security where you have to go through metal detectors and pat downs and x-ray machines and all that stuff. It's basically like going into an airport.
If you ask me, that's insane. But here in Europe, I guess we're much more free on the surface, so you don't get checked. They don't care much about what you do. You can just walk into a fun park and go on roller coasters all day long and they will not ask for any ID. But at the same time, we have much stricter and harsher secret services, like the intelligence. They know all about the people who cross the border. They can check on you. And My father works for the Romanian equivalent of the IRS, and he told me that he has to work at the border from time to time because they cut their funding and they use the same employees who work in the desks to go to the border and do checks like every, for a week every year or something like that. And he told me that when somebody enters the border, they just take their passports or IDs and they scan them. and they can see on the screen everything, like where they traveled, if they have any criminal records, everything about them. They can just see it on the spot. And I'm not sure if you have that in the United States, or I'm sure you have it in the airports, but I'm not sure if everywhere.
Yeah, well, you know, we definitely have that on all of the borders in like the edge of the country. Thankfully, we don't have to go through that scrutiny when we cross the borders of states inside of the country. So, you know, you can go nearly 4,000 miles from coast to coast without having to go through a checkpoint like that. Though there are a number of checkpoints because some legislation was passed that basically gave our Customs and Border Control agents the legal authority to operate anywhere within 100 miles of the border. And if you actually draw along the coastline and the borders with Canada and Mexico, 100 miles inside of the border actually covers something like 80% of the population of America. Pretty much everybody lives, you know, along the coastline on the east or west coast. So they do have jurisdiction over a lot of things. And I have come across a few random outposts in the middle of nowhere on like long motorcycle trips where there will be nothing but a road and trees. And then all of a sudden there's a guard post and there's like military people standing there that, you know, ask for your ID. And it's really weird because it's pretty rare, but they do have the authority to do that.
What is your explanation or argument when people say, I have nothing to hide, I'm such a good citizen, I obey the law, there's nothing that I do wrong, so I have nothing to hide. Why would I care about my privacy? How do you explain to these people that they should actually care, and KYC or controlling your passport or ID should not be the norm, and you should be a free person, a free citizen of your own country?
Yeah, so it's more of a problem of you don't know what data might be used against you in the future. And this really becomes more apparent when you start looking at like the way the legal system operates, where, you know, even if you are remotely suspected of some sort of crime, law enforcement will just start digging through your entire past. And if they can find anything that is suspicious or gives them some sort of probable cause to dig into you and try to start creating problems for you, then it's pretty easy to do so. You know, one way that I've phrased this is that in the modern age, at least in America, and I'm assuming probably with most countries that have reasonably large legal and judicial systems, we very rarely delete laws. We just keep writing and creating more and more laws year after year, decade after decade, to the point that there are so many laws on the books that like even lawyers don't know all of the laws. Like lawyers have to specialize in one specific portion of the law. And so as a result of that, we are all criminals. It's basically impossible to be alive and not commit a crime on a regular basis. I think that there's a number of interesting articles out there that are titled something like a crime a day or something, or a felony a day or something. But basically like all of these inane laws, many of which I would argue should probably not exist or should have been, you know, struck from the records long ago, that if government agents want to put you in jail, it's highly likely that they will be able to find a crime that you committed, even if it's not, you know, an egregious crime where, you know, there is a victim necessarily. There's a ton of victimless crimes on the books now as well. So I would argue that the only way to protect yourself from that is to keep as much of your activities private as possible, so that it's harder for someone to pin you with a crime that probably shouldn't even be a crime.
I actually watched Magical Crypto Friends, and Whale Panda said that during, I'm not sure which conference he attended, and he listened to you have a speech about privacy, but he said that many of the measures that you're taking and you've mentioned in the speech are not applicable in Europe. because in here we have like a personal identification number, and it's harder for you to just erase your identity or run away. Plus, I remember when I was in Paris and I've studied there for a semester as an exchange, I couldn't do anything without a bank account. I couldn't have a phone number. I couldn't rent a place. There was basically nothing that I could do without getting a bank account. And for that, I actually needed so many documents that in the end, I ended up being illegally renting and illegally buying like a phone number from somebody.
Yeah.
Just because the bureaucracy was ridiculous, not because I had anything to hide or because I was a criminal.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the protections that I put in place use various, and this is actually one of the reasons why it's actually helpful that America is so large and has so many different states and jurisdictions, is that you can often find jurisdictions that are more lenient and have more loopholes. And so the stuff that I've done takes advantage of some of those more lenient jurisdictions that have better privacy. So I, you know, create legal entities in those jurisdictions, and then I use those legal entities to perform various actions, such as purchasing property or setting up utilities and other types of accounts that are tied to my normal day-to-day life. And, it's not clear to me whether or not, you know, a European could set up a legal entity like that in America and then use it in Europe, or, you know, what the options are. And the downside to all of this, kind of the conclusion that I came to, is that, you know, because of all of these regulations that governments have put in place, they've basically priced most people out of privacy. The only way that you can have privacy is if you have a huge amount of wealth, like to the level that you can afford to pay for lawyers to do the legal research, to find the loopholes, to figure out how to set up these complex legal entities on your behalf. And that's really, you know, one of the reasons why I guess wealthy people also tend to have more freedom is because you basically create a shield between yourself and the government with lawyers. You know, the lawyers are kind of like the, you know, defensive football players or what have you, that are, you know, protecting you from being attacked by the government, because they know how to use the government's own laws against it.
You think that these immutable blockchains that we have now can actually be a leverage for us to negotiate with the governments and tell them, give us back our autonomy and give us back some rights, and you may have access, or we may allow you to use them or whatever? Like, when you are in charge of your own money and you're trying basically to take away the government's power to control you with their currency, you think that you're basically inviting the government to negotiate with you and say, we want you to use our currency and we want you to be a regular citizen, but how can we actually enact some sort of policy in order to make this category of people be happy, or stop this from spreading to the extent that our currency becomes redundant?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of is the thesis of the sovereign individual, that, you know, technology will give more power back to the individuals because we'll be able to replace more of the services that people are used to being provided by the government, and replace those with basically new technological means of coordinating on our own in a voluntary fashion. So, you know, if we can then build more privatized voluntary services that compete with governments and their public services, then that will finally put nation states, you know, kind of back on their heels, because they'll finally have to compete in a free market rather than being able to just exercise a monopoly over all of these different aspects of our lives. But, you know, it's not going to be easy either. You know, there's going to be a lot of people who fight back against that and say, no, you know, we have to have the government coordinating everything. Otherwise, it's just going to be chaos. And so, you know, I think it's going to get more contentious before it gets better. I don't think it's going to be a very smooth transition by any means.
But do you think that there is going to be a transition by the way you formulated your sentence?
Well, you know, that's what I am focusing on. And I think that's what a lot of us are trying to do, is we're trying to make that transition happen. You know, you can get into a debate as to whether or not it is inevitable. But I think whether or not it is inevitable, there have to be people behind the movement that actually build the technology and make it possible to happen in the first place. And that, you know, a lot of those of us that are on the forefront of that are also exposed and would very easily be, you know, the first ones against the wall, as it were, if there was some sort of backlash against this movement.
So I guess this is the last question, but do you see Bitcoin as a mean of resistance?
Definitely. I mean, it's a rejection of you know, monetary policy that is controlled by bankers and nation states. And you know, of course, it goes far beyond Bitcoin at this point. And it's really just a rejection of the status quo, saying, you know, we want to build a completely new system that is more open and that we have more input into seeing how it operates. And so that's why I got involved originally, was because I felt like the concept of money is just a concept that belongs to humanity in general. You know, it is a shared agreement. It is not something that is supposed to be dictated as to how it operates. So, you know, there should not be a small group of elite people that are controlling it. It should be something where anyone who is interested, they should be able to contribute and have input as to, you know, how money itself should operate. And so that's why I started contributing.
Okay. Thank you very much. This was very enlightening and inspiring on my behalf. I hope that the viewers will think the same. And I hope that I'll talk to you some other time and maybe talk about other topics like the Lightning Network and how distributed and spread it has become, because I know that you keep like tabs on how many Lightning nodes have been deployed so far. And maybe by then we will talk about a quick and easy implementation which anyone can use. And maybe we'll have many more side chains to solve other problems, and we'll see the end of all these shit coins, and maybe we will have witnessed the end of the bear market. So thank you very much for this interview, and have a nice rest of your day.
My pleasure. Thanks.